listen to music and podcasts from CGSF 90.1 FM with our radio app. It's on-the-go listening made easy. You can tune into all our music, spoken word, and multicultural shows using your device. Our app lets you set reminders so you'll never miss your favorite show again. Stay connected to CGSF 90.1 FM through our community radio app. Download the app from the Apple Store or get it on Google Play.
Hey, SFU! Getting money back for all your empty or refundable bottles and cans just got a lot easier. Just sign up for Returned Express for free. You can bag your containers, tag the bag, and drop it through the window at the new Express and Go container in the East parking lot. Return It will count your containers and credit your refunds to your online account. Learn more at returnit.ca/SFU.
You're listening to CJSF at 90.1 FM in Burnaby. CJSF is diverse, independent, and yours. Underrepresented music, local voices, and real people. You keep CJSF independent.
I'm Jesse Brown, and today we're going to tell you the story of the most audacious prison break in Canadian history.
How did they do it? Investigators will not say, but there are reports a plasma-cutting torch was used to cut a hole in the fence.
Wait for that. Robbie Al-Khalil was serving time for one murder and on trial for another. Then on July 21st, 2022, he slipped into a black jumpsuit and a high-visibility vest, and he walked out the front door of a BC prison. He hopped into a white van and disappeared.
Al-Khalil could be anywhere. Police say the 35-year-old has connections in Canada, the U.S., Europe, and Asia.
Back in 2021, before the escape, we did an episode on Al-Khalil and the gang that he fronted, the Wolfpack. This was before the prison break. On that episode, we were profiling Al-Khalil and the Wolfpack as personifications of a new breed of gangster. Tech-savvy, woke, millennial mobsters who were not limited by the racial and geographic boundaries that constrained and defined older groups like the Hells Angels or Montreal's Mafia families. You've got Portuguese members, you've got like French-Canadian white guys, Irish white guys, Punjabi, Italian, Chinese. It seems like there was, I don't know, a lack of racial prejudice or a willingness for people to work together.
I mean, the Hells Angels have so many rules and other bike clubs in their constitutions, 40-something pages. Like, they've got rules for everything. But these guys are, it's more like, can you make money for us? Can you be useful to us?
Robbie Al-Khalil popped back up on our radar last week when, after 3 years on the run following that jailbreak, a series of news reports from abroad claimed that he'd been arrested in Qatar. Strangely, that bombshell revelation was only the second most interesting piece of news to come out of Qatar last week. Anyhow, the RCMP scheduled a press conference and promised an update on the case.
This press conference is about the arrest of three men who have been charged in the investigation into the escape of Robbie Al-Khalil.
But then, something weird happened.
There are unconfirmed media reports that Robbie Al-Khalil is in custody. However, we do not have confirmation of his arrest. We will not be able to provide any further information in regard to this matter. If that information changes, we will update you accordingly.
The RCMP announced that three men had been charged in connection with helping Al-Khalil escape. But the RCMP would neither confirm nor deny that Al-Khalil had been caught abroad. How to make sense of this? Well, we called up Peter Edwards, veteran crime beat reporter at the Toronto Star. He literally wrote the book on the Wolfpack. It's called The Wolfpack, The Millennial Mobsters Who Brought Chaos and the Cartels to the Canadian Underworld. And Peter Edwards has spent years tracking the twists and turns of Robbie Al-Khalil's escape and subsequent manhunt. He's got the full story for you. Wait for it. Can you tell me who you are and what you do?
I'm Peter Edwards. I'm a reporter at the Toronto Star. I cover organized crime, and I've been there for 40 years.
Can you just, like, take me to that July day of the escape and tell me the story of what happened that day, point by point?
It's kind of a Mission Impossible type of stuff because he was in prison for first-degree murder. That day, two maintenance workers went into the jail, maximum security with uniforms, under cameras. Somehow, not long after that, three maintenance workers walked out. There was a hole cut in a wall, and Robbie Al-Khalil all of a sudden was in a uniform walking with the two people who looked like workers out the front door.
Now, suspect one is described as a Caucasian male, last seen wearing a white hard hat, a face mask, black shirt with a high visibility vest, and black clothing. Suspect number two, also a Caucasian male, wearing a black ball cap, face mask, glasses, essentially head to toe in black.
They got into a white Econoline van. They were about 45 minutes from the border. Almost 45 minutes later, police released a video.
Local and international police are now hoping that the release of the video and images will help lead to the capture of the accused killer and his accomplices.
That turned out to not be accurate. The images that were put out by authorities turned out to be stock images easily available on the internet, and we didn't know what the accomplices looked like because bogus images had been broadcast.
What did the bogus images look like?
Two guys with really short hair, two white guys who looked kind of severe, looked a bit like Russian hockey players. I mean, they're kind of severe guys with short hair.
How long had he been in this detention center, like roughly?
A couple months. The trial had been going on, and so you could ask, how did he know where to stand? How did they know his size? How did he know how to dig a hole in the wall? How did he know when they'd be coming in? Those are all fair questions.
Those are good questions. This isn't like a Shawshank Redemption thing where he's been there serving a life sentence and, like, can really take his sweet time in figuring a way out. Meanwhile, he's, like, on trial, so you figure his mind is preoccupied with not being found guilty on trial, but he's able to actually engineer this audacious jailbreak while he's only been there for really weeks. Peter, you've been covering crime for four decades. Is this a one in a million jailbreak? Like just the story itself is incredible. I don't know much about Canadian history of jail escapes, but is this like a standalone case or Hall of Fame, or where would you rank this?
It's past the Hall of Fame. It's like the Galaxy Hall of Fame. Most of the jailbreaks are guys just not returning. Like, you get a pass and you just run away and you're on minimum security anyway and you get caught in a bar 2 weeks later. It's not that big of a deal. I don't have anything to compare this to. The out the front door in a uniform under the cameras and nobody knows what continent he's on for three years.
So you quote this former cop, Cash Heed, who served as the Solicitor General of BC back in 2009, 2010. And here's the quote that you got from this former cop. I have never in my 32 years in policing and my time since policing seen such an inept investigation on a suspected murderer that has escaped from one of our secure institutions. Can you talk about why he would put it in such extreme terms? Like, how rare a thing is this jailbreak?
It would be hard to top this. Walking out the front door of a jail while you're on trial for first-degree murder after being convicted of another murder and tinkering with the internet. The tinkering with the internet's the one that I've been covering this stuff since the 80s, and I've never had anyone actually tap into a police system before a computer system on this level. You get a little rinky-dinky things or even mid-level things, but to actually get in and be that confident that you've got the security cameras tampered with, that's extremely high end.
What are we to make of this erroneous image? It's not that the authorities were trying to trick anybody. It's that when they went into their system to get these images, somebody had monkeyed with the system and put these, like, very easy to tell fake images in the system in place of where the actual security footage should have been.
Yes, although when they made arrests, they wouldn't comment on if anyone was connected to the correction system. And I'd been trying through Freedom of Information searches to find out if there had been any reassignments, suspensions, discipline of staff connected to the jail, and I've never been stonewalled that loudly. Uh-huh. Like I couldn't get anything. I thought it'd be interesting if they had a review, if they changed the staff. I mean, there are only so many people in the jail when he broke out. You'd think that they'd be suspects. You have to ask, how did he even know where to be, where to stand? There was a hole dug in a wall of the jail. How do you dig a hole in the wall of a jail without being noticed? And it was maximum security. I mean, you are supposed to be keeping an eye on these guys.
So it's a reasonable suspicion that perhaps he had help from somebody who works there, and you've been trying to get to the bottom of that, and you've been stonewalled like never before. There's this audacious high-tech jailbreak to begin with, and then there's the fact that there doesn't seem to be any kind of repercussions for anybody working in the system. We last spoke about Khalil and the Wolf Pack in, like, what, 2021 or something, 2020? A lot has happened to Robbie Khalil since you and I last spoke. But maybe you could just refresh people's memory as to who this guy is.
There were five Al Khalil brothers. They came to Canada in 1990. They were stateless. They're Palestinian. They first moved to Saudi Arabia and then came to Surrey, BC. Their parents said they were bringing them there for education. Since then, of the five brothers, three were murdered. It was all in drug-related things. Robbie was convicted of two first-degree murders, one in a drug deal where a huge amount of cocaine was coming into Canada. There were four partners. They figured they'd make more money if it was only three partners, so they murdered one of them.
He's been on the run for years now on our Be on the Lookout For, like, one of the most wanted fugitives in Canada.
And $250,000 reward at one point.
Al Khalil was never found by Canadian authorities. He may be in custody in Qatar, but charges were laid against people who are allegedly his accomplices in helping him escape. So how do they catch those guys, and what do we know about that?
That gets really interesting. First, to know Al Khalil's in Qatar, that'd be a small, small group. Like, that's a really, really trusted inner group. So that suggests that someone in Al Khalil's group has turned on him. And that would explain why police are pretty guarded. There's a attempted murder charge in the latest batch. And what it appears is that when they were digging into where is Robbie Al Khalil, they stumbled onto a murder plot and they had to make arrests on that so that someone wouldn't be killed. If you check the charges, there are five, but three are directly about Robbie Al Khalil. Two are ones they stumbled onto that are about a murder, and a couple are from Ottawa, which points back to where some of the Al Khalils were for a while. If you're chasing Robbie Al Khalil, you can't allow someone to be murdered. Like, you have to act on that one. And so all of a sudden, the bad guys know that somebody's talking.
What do you know about who found him in Qatar or what he was arrested for? Was one of those things where he was on a list and somebody stopped him for a traffic thing, or he was trying to cross a border? They found his name, or was he up to something there? Do you know anything about how he was unconfirmed but apprehended in Qatar?
The big thing about Qatar is it's hard to be extradited from, but it's not a fun place. Like, the smart money was on Dubai. You can have a good time with a different identity in Dubai and sort of live your best life. Qatar is not a fun place, and now that it's been bombed by Israel, it's a lot less fun.
Just say that journalism is so hollowed out in this country that something that the public is so obsessed with, crime reporting, in another country you'd think that we would already be watching the HBO series about this. I didn't even know that this had happened years ago, this jailbreak, until he's recently allegedly apprehended in Qatar. You are among like a very small group of remaining crime reporters in this country who are like, it's like you're at an all-you-can-eat buffet with like lobster and prime rib, and there's only three people there. Like, your cup runneth over. Like, who do we have left? It's you, Adrian Humphreys, Kim Bolin. Like, who's left?
Quebec's pretty good, actually. If you had to pick where the majority of good crime reporters are, the competition in Montreal is quite something. But what's interesting is it used to be, if it's big in Toronto, it's probably big in Montreal. And so, like, I could do stuff on the Rizzuto crime family and I could get good Hells Angels stuff. Now I'm having to look a lot more towards the West Coast. On the upside for people like me, I've got better sources off the internet. There's a lot of people at 3 a.m. who kind of let loose and send you a message when maybe they shouldn't, or wanting to chat or wondering what happened to so-and-so, or do you know so-and-so is up for parole? You know, are you going to attend? The internet, as much as I'm not very good on it, I get a lot of messages that I wouldn't normally, that 20 years ago, I wouldn't have gotten a phone call and I wouldn't have met with people. They would have been more restrained. Now it's amazing how people feel the need to tell their stories.
Yeah, the act of self-chronicling, it's just been widely distributed now and people are very interested in, they're kind of watching people watch them and they care about how that story is told. I think a lot of people would look at it as reckless for people who are otherwise so smart to be like posting images of themselves on the internet. Like what would be an example of this kind of behavior?
Well, went so far as they post on Parliament Hill where our leaders gather.
Like a gangster's field trip?
Yeah, gangster's field trip and also power, like sort of, you know, we run this country, at least part of it.
What is the big outstanding question? What is the biggest mystery about this case for you?
How did he get out the front door? What level of corruption does it take that he could walk out the front door? One thing, a long, long time ago, I went to Sicily and I talked to an organized crime reporter there and I was just kind of getting directions. And he said that to be a real organized criminal, you need corruption. You can't do it without corruption. You and I can plot bad things all day, but if we don't have someone in power helping us out, it's going to stop. But if you have corruption, then you move on and you maybe become a developer in Woodbridge or something, or city council, but you're not hiding far, far away. The level of corruption it would take, the amount of phones they have in custody is kind of off the charts. And if you're a guard, you don't want the prisoners mad at you. So you bend a little here and you bend a little there because you want to get through your day. Just thinking about it, how many people had to be compromised for Al-Khalil to get out? And there are really good cops and really honest cops. And I can't imagine how jumpy they get. And an odd thing in my job is that clean people don't mind me going after dirty people in authority. You'd think they'd circle the wagons more, but they don't. It's sort of my job to try and find them and do something about them.
So it seems more than reasonable to imagine that there must have been some corruption, or at least it's a reasonable question to ask. It's been 3 years since this jailbreak. Has anyone been charged? And if so, who?
They did announce 3 charges relating to the jailbreak, but that's it. And if you think that it's either massive, massive incompetence, I mean, that 2 people walk in and 3 walk out and you don't get suspicious, or how did they get the uniforms? How did you know where to be standing? The level of incompetence for it not to be corruption, it would be quite something.
There is a national uproar right now around the rise in crime, or the perception of the rise in crime and the rise in crime. From your perspective, as somebody who's in regular contact with criminals, do they feel like they're like having a golden age right now?
But it's not really fun because it means anybody can shoot you. Like, there's one former Hell's Angel, Lauren Campbell, who I got to know really well and did a book on him, and he doesn't feel good about it, but he did shoot a guy to death thinking that the guy was about to shoot his friends, and so he felt that it was justified, and it was a really big deal that he had a gun for this. Like, they had a gun in the group and they gave the gun to him and it was his job. Now everybody's got a gun. This former bad guy I talked to, he talks about how they'd shred guns, how they'd have guns hidden in Vancouver and different. They'd have apartments, or they do have apartments, and in the apartment is a safe and in the safe is guns. So they don't have to be carrying a gun. They just have to drive to the place and get the gun. And now getting a gun is absolutely nothing, and it's not limited to organized criminals. Lots of people have them now.
That's like a city bike. That's like the electronic scooter that you use an app to check out. That's like Communauto or something.
That's the frightening part, is the, in Toronto, do we go 3 weeks without a bystander story now? I mean, for Hamilton, the student who just got shot to death, if you have two carloads full of people with guns, then everybody standing between them's got a problem. Like now lower end people are getting guns and they don't know how to shoot them. Like the weird thing is for all the firepower, it's very bad marksmanship. So a lot of them, you hear about 12 bullets fired and nobody got hit. And so they'll go next night, shoot 12 more at each other and see what they can do that time. And it's really bad for anybody standing in the middle.
Kids these days.
Sorry. I mean, it does sound a little... When I hear it coming out of my mouth, I think, you know, what kind of a job did I choose?
Peter, thank you for telling me about all this. That is your Canada Land. You can email me about what you heard at jesse@canadaland.com. Our senior producer is Bruce Thorson. Audio production and editing from Caleb Thompson. Today's episode was fact-checked by Julian Abraham. Canada Land's director of audio is Max Collins. I am the editor and publisher of Canada Land. Our theme music is by So Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it. I'm Jesse Brown, and today we are talking about the news. We'll talk about Carney's major nation-building projects. How big are they? We'll say goodbye to Babar, Franklin, and the Magic School Bus. We'll talk about the hostages, bring them home from Russia, and we'll talk about Chinese EVs. And why can't I get one? And what does that even have to do with canola oil? Because it does.
China's electric vehicle juggernaut is conquering the world.
They're not just ahead, they're also selling things for like a good value.
A beast so gargantuan and so ravenous that in the end, it might just be unstoppable.
Wait for that. First things first, we have been waiting for Prime Minister Mark Carney to tell us what his nation-building projects are. He has announced the first wave. He did so in Edmonton.
Today, as you know, Canada's new government is announcing the first set of projects that we believe are both in Canada's national interest and are feasible to be built.
And what is most notable is what is not on the list. No pipeline, no Ring of Fire development in Ontario, and nothing east of Montreal. No projects in the Maritimes. So what is on this list? Five projects.
These five projects will generate more than $60 billion for the Canadian economy.
Phase two of LNG, Liquid Natural Gas Canada, in Kitimat, BC.
This project will double LNG Canada's production capacity and make it the second largest liquefied natural gas facility of its kind in the world.
The Darlington New Nuclear Project in Clarington, Ontario. They'll be making modular nuclear reactors.
Darlington's first of four planned SMR units will provide reliable, affordable, clean power to 300,000 homes.
The Port of Montreal is going to be expanded.
Collaborer avec le Port de Montréal afin de déterminer comment faire avancer les travaux d'aménagement portuaire au terminal de Contrecoeur.
The Foran Copper Mine Project in Saskatchewan is on the list.
Critical minerals and mining are industries of national interest in and of themselves. And to these ends, we are referring the McKinvenna Bay Foran Copper Mine in east central Saskatchewan.
And the expansion of the Red Chris Mine in northwest BC.
And the Red Chris Copper and Gold Mine in northwestern BC. Foran will strengthen Canada's position as a global supplier of critical minerals for clean energy, advanced manufacturing, and modern infrastructure.
It seems that Carney may have been doing a little bit of preemptive damage control. He was in Atlantic Canada before this major project announcement, announcing tariff relief. So that's what they get for now. And he met with Danielle Smith just before. I guess there was something in it for her, too, because she said it was a good meeting.
I would say that my meeting with the Prime Minister was about as encouraging as any meeting I've had with the federal government in a long time.
Carney has gestured towards more good news, nation-building news to come. He talked about a pipeline as part of a future wave paired with a carbon capture project.
There is a grand bargain, which pairs pathways, a major decarbonization project with a new pipeline.
He mentioned the possibility of Nova Scotia's Wind West Atlantic Energy Project.
Part of a broader Energy East partnership amongst the Atlantic provinces. With Wind West, this partnership could include important interties between New Brunswick, Nova Scotia, and Newfoundland.
Perhaps the Ring of Fire will get some love in the news to come.
Opportunities include Ontario's Ring of Fire.
Grays Bay, we did a whole episode about this road in the Arctic. Nothing in the first wave for the Arctic, but he did mention that maybe that's coming down the line.
By creating a new port at Grays Bay and unlocking our resources.
Was he specific about when we're going to find out about these future projects? Indeed, he was. He did give us some clarity as to the timeline of these future announcements. He was very cup-focused.
There'll be another tranche of the Grey Cup, certainly another one by the Stanley Cup, another one by the World Cup.
He is diligently sticking to a sports metaphor-based policy regimen. Are the Conservatives happy with these announcements? No, they are not. It ain't enough. The Hub with a piece. With no new pipeline reportedly planned, how serious is Carney about actually turning this economy around? Pierre Poilievre says that Canada has lost 86,000 jobs since Carney became PM, $62 billion in net investment. We're the fastest shrinking G7 economy. And it's taken him 6 months to write a list of five projects to send for further review to a new government office that is not even fully staffed. To say he is moving at a snail's pace is an insult to snails. Spicy snail-related diss there. Brian Lilly of Post Media of the Toronto Sun writing that this is an incredibly weak list of quote-unquote major projects of national interest. He said he was going to build big and build fast. We've been sold a bill of goods. I'll note that Mark Carney made these announcements from some kind of a very vocational, blue-collary Edmonton carpentry training-type facility.
Okay, so that's a toolbox.
Yeah.
With a nail tray.
Yeah, nail tray, everything in there. Keep it by you.
He was very much in home improvement dad costume, awkwardly hammering away as part of the theater of this announcement. He made a point of expressing solidarity with labor.
Take a moment to salute the union leaders, the great union leaders from across this country.
All the union leaders, perhaps, except for the union leaders at Air Canada, because, of course, Mark Carney recently ordered Air Canada's workers back to work. Speaking of organized labor in Canada, I wonder how the Canadian auto workers are going to feel about the prospect of Chinese EVs being allowed into Canada, which is what we're going to talk about next. Jan Wong, welcome back to the show.
Hi.
EV adoption is hitting record highs in China. They are one of the first big countries to go crazy with the technology.
China's electric vehicle juggernaut is conquering the world.
They're not just ahead, they're also selling things for like a good value.
A modern-day behemoth of design and manufacturing. It produces more EVs than every other nation on Earth combined.
Hey, Jen, when you lived in China, how were the cars?
I lived in China a long time. So in 1972, which was a million years ago exactly, we rode bikes everywhere. And the only cars were Chinese-made kind of clumsy things with sort of sheer curtains over the passenger window so no one could see the official who was privileged enough. And then later when I was there as a journalist, the first clunky cars came in and no one could drive. It was really fun. It was like those bumper car games at the CNE. And then now they're totally modern. They have wonderful cars, wonderful freeways. It's amazing.
I think they have the best cars.
They have the best cars.
I think they've gone from having no cars and crappy cars. Look at, like, you can't get these cars here. Look at these features.
Yeah.
Look at this. There's a sleeping kit. This is the XPeng G9 for around 50K Canadian, an SUV that turns into a bed. It's like a hotel room inside this thing. There are features in these Chinese EVs that we do not have yet. This is a luxury sedan. This is expensive. This is